You're listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. Find out how you can join us for a live show at the Cactus at cactuscafe.org. Here with us tonight for A Views and Brews to talk about communication, to talk about the importance of voices of young people, about the struggles and opportunities ahead when it comes to communication and media, we have the co-founder of Purpose, a strategic services company that helps organizations and people around the world share their stories, Lana McGilvery. Thank you for coming. Also with us tonight from the Texas Standard, reporter and producer, Joy Diaz. Thank you for being here, Joy. And all the way from North Carolina, we have the founder of We Are Gen Z. She's also the brilliant mind behind the Pope emojis. Anyone? Kathleen Hessert, welcome.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
So as we get started, I just wanted each of you to kind of talk a little bit about why you're here, why you think communication is important, and about your backgrounds in communication. Lana, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I'll try and make it brief. I've been thinking about communication since I was a little girl, and Rebecca, you're on the board of a storytelling event that we do, Pecha Kucha, but I hadn't really thought about it. So Pecha Kucha is an international event, and my husband DJ, who's in the audience, not a woman in communication, and I have been co-directing the series here in Austin, and usually we produce and we ask people to tell their stories, and so recently the Pecha Kucha curatorial board asked me to tell mine, and it put me in a seat that I'm not used to being in, because I have been a journalist and then a publicist for the past 20 years. And so I like to be behind the camera or listen to other people's stories. But I realized, and the reason I'm here on stage today, is I had a personal story that started when I was a child. I was born in Lebanon, and my dad was a doctor, my mom was Australian, and we came to the States because of the war. And when I moved here, I was moving away from a culture I loved. One of my aunts was a journalist. She was leading the production of CNN out there and Al Jazeera, and she was telling really complicated stories. And so I guess I was attuned to storytelling from the time that I was young. And fast forward, I went through college and graduate school, and I was actually one of those students that got a scholarship for graduate school to public communications, and I've been practicing journalism and PR my entire career. I did traditional things. I went to a public television series after graduate school, and then I practiced in advertising and traditional publicity. But over the past 2 years, I've been extremely active with a group of pioneers. Kathleen Hessert over here, my mentor, is one of them. She, throughout my career, I'd done lots of different projects that were fun with her, but she had started a foundation called We Are Gen Z, and we started hitting the road with young people and listening more than talking for them, and that really inspired me. And then I was on the road with another group of women that were older than me. They were women leading a global technology organization. And so anyways, long story short, I quit my job, my day job, on April 15th, tax day, this year. And I left part of my career behind me, and I started a new company focused on helping organizations and people I care about around the world tell their stories. So that's why I'm here.
Named Purpose.
Named Purpose.
Can't forget the name of the company.
A good publicist over here.
Joy, what about you? You've been in media for a long time. You've
for
been
a
journalist.
Long time, and it's hard to tell because I look so young. But you know, one of the things that I love about my job is this: listening to stories. Because you see a person, but it's until you see the story that you fall in love. Like now. But in my case, I was born in Mexico City, My parents were missionaries. My father was an American man, and not a white man, an American man. And my mother was very young, and they went into missions. And they were a dynamic couple. When I think about the things that they did, it's just like amazing. My parents did missionary work in garbage dumps. They established small clinics, dental clinics, food pantries, elementary schools, and showers in 10 different garbage dumps in Mexico City. So I am in communications because my father was a master communicator. He would go with very wealthy individuals, and he would tell them their the stories of the people he was helping, and then he would say, I think you should sponsor Monday breakfast. And then people would be like, sure. And he'd say, but I don't think you can sponsor Monday breakfast without cooking Monday breakfast. And so he would bring like the CEOs of Bacardi and, you know, and like the bread companies. And in Mexico, the most famous bread is called Bimbo. Who knows? But Bic, the pen company. And so he would bring them down, and they would cook breakfast one day and give showers to the children and, you know, sort the clothing and send them to school. And it just, you know, left a big impression on people, and they would come back. So he would always have support. But he was also very much a people person to any person. So the children who lived in the garbage dumps were not... definitely not clean children. And doing that type of mission meant that I know what it's like to swallow flies when you're talking because they're in your mouth, and out of respect for the people you're with, you don't dare to spit them out. And my dad just said, you know, you go with that flow, and out of respect for people, you don't do that. And so, I remember he loved wearing white clothes and kids just, you know, covered in mud because they lived in the garbage dump would just come and hug him. And he never winced. He never once went. He always embraced people. And so that taught me to see the God in everyone, you know. And so my commitment when I do stories is to talk to everyone. Because I don't care where you come from, your story is important. And I don't care how much you make, your story is important. Whether you make too much or too little, I want to hear your story. And that's one of the things that I've been doing, particularly in Austin, because I've been working in radio in Austin, not in print as I trained to do in Mexico City. But that's one of the things that I do, is I look for the person that nobody's talking to. That's the person I want to talk to.
And I can't tell you how many times I've been at the station and Joy's been editing a show and I've walked past her desk and she's in tears. And I'm like, what? And she's like, you never believe this woman I spoke to today. And so,
that is so true.
The personal investment that Joy brings to each story is really commendable. And we all appreciate it here in Austin. So thank you for
that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to be in tears.
We won't make you cry, yeah. But Kathleen, what about you? You've had such an extensive career in media and really groundbreaking in a lot of ways. You were the first anchor of a sports program in New York City, and you've been working in sports for a long time. And what drove you to be such a trailblazer, as they were?
My mother taught me and said over and over and over again, you can be anything you want to be if you just do your best. And if your best is only average, there's nothing wrong with average. You hear that over and over and over again, and you understand and truly believe that anything is possible. And so from the time I was 13, I wanted to be a journalist. I went to the University of Notre Dame and St. Mary's College and started working in radio there and sent out 100 resumes after my graduation. This is for everybody who's graduating these days. I had literally 100 I sent out to television stations around the country, and I had 100 more waiting to go out if the first group didn't work. And I got a job in Syracuse, New York at the TV station up there. It was WHEN-TV. And the day I started, the newspaper headline read, "Station Hires Second Woman." That's how odd it was. That was in October of 1974. And I was a 22-year-old kid. All I knew how to do was, you know, I knew I was smart. I knew I could ask good questions. But I was so out of it in terms of the world and reality. I didn't know what a privileged life I had lived. And so I used every big word I could because I thought, well, that would make me credible. You know, when I was in my apartment, I had pigtails and cutoffs and bare feet. But when I went out, I had to put my makeup on because I was a role model, whether I knew it or not. And finally, my news director called me in after about 6 months and he said, Kathleen, half the people out there don't understand a single word you're saying. And he said, you will be a better reporter if when you go cover a story, you ask yourself, what does this mean to your audience and why should they care? Those are the two best questions that I have ever heard, and they've driven my communication ever since. So I just went around doing what I wanted to do. 9 years I was in television. Then my husband wanted to start a business developing housing for the poor in rural areas of the South. So we moved to this dinky little town in South Carolina that had more cows than people. We had our two kids, and I thought my brain was going to mush. So I thought, all right, I'm going to teach executives how to deal with the media, public speaking, crisis management, those kinds of things. And I did it and was very successful from the very start because I was building on my previous career. Then in 1988, my brother was a championship race car driver. He won the Daytona 24 Hours. He too listened to our mother and our father and said he could do anything he wanted to do. And I realized he got out of the car and he sounded like a pure idiot. You know, I'm like, oh my God, this is my brother. He's smart. He wants to help his sponsors. He can talk. What is going on? And I realized what I was doing that might be having a weekly or a monthly application for executives had a daily application in sports. So I started a sports division, Sports Media Challenge, and I went to the University of Notre Dame and I said, you've got smart kids. You've got great exposure. It's immoral to give them all the best equipment and facilities and training on the football field and then send them out and literally give them no training to speak to the media. So Notre Dame had the first media training for college athletes and coaches. I really lucked out. It was wonderful. Soon after that, the NFL hired me to design their media training. Then the Olympic Committee brought me in, and it just blossomed. At one point, I was working on behalf of the Pope and P. Diddy at the same time. Couldn't have been more diverse, except when people asked me, what's the difference between your athletes and your executives and the Pope? I'd say, the uniform. Everybody had the same challenges. It wasn't comfortable to speak, even stuff that you knew and understand, with someone shining lights in your eyes or with a microphone in your face or asking you pointed questions when you were exhausted or in an emotional state. And so my business is about building communication champions, wherever they are. And when I realized that nobody was listening to young people and that there was nobody representing Gen Z, kids now ages, say, 8 through 22, 23 years old, that people were talking about them but not listening to them or giving them a voice. It must be my reporter in the background that said, you need to start a thought leadership area on Gen Z. So I did, and now we have over 1,000 kids in a think tank. We do original research, and we provide opportunities and internships and media interviews so that the world and brands can better understand young people. In 2020, Gen Z will be 40% of the U.S. population and 37% of the global population. They spend at a minimum in the U.S. $44 billion a year, and they influence over $600 billion a year in household spending. If you do not understand Gen Z, the world is going where Gen Z is going, and we need to be on their tail. We need to be there with them. So that's where a lot of my efforts are right now, helping the world communicate with young people, and young people have their voices heard.
Woo! Yes. So on that, what are the biggest challenges now? What do you think the biggest challenges in media are today, not only in communicating with Gen Z, but also just in communication in the media landscape?
People don't listen. If they listened, then they would, and truly tried to understand. Like, instead of trying to show what you know and say what you know, but literally listen and say, my job here is to help you understand something and have a clear idea of what that is, and make that connection, whether it be on social media or it be, you know, in a writing piece or it be face to face. You know, we have to connect better and respect other people. We've lost civility and we've lost our curiosity in many ways. We haven't acted on that curiosity, at least. I think we've become numb to all the information that's available to us.
But I also think the monetization model for media right now completely underscores that challenge. So we do not live in an environment, and I think you know part of my story, but when I was in graduate school, my graduate school professor was in his 90s, and he was one of the people that brought public media to the US. And at the time that he did that, there was originally three stations, and so there was limited inventory for us to hear the stories, and we created the public media interest laws that have dictated public media in the US. But right now, we don't have any of those protections, because in a digital environment where there are literally infinite channels, those protections don't mean much anymore. In the way that the advertising model works, we're incented to get clicks and easy BuzzFeedy type things. And so when you're competing for that attention span and you see things happen like a 6-second video is the average, you know, if you want to get your message across, it limits your opportunity to even have an audience that tunes in. So the media structure itself is not helping any in the current environment.
And one thing that I have noticed as well is that one of our challenges is that we live in silos, not just political silos, but professional silos as well. And when we live in silos, we don't learn what the other person is doing. We don't learn about their stories, therefore we don't develop empathy about their stories. But not only that, we don't learn to work as a team. I was telling these ladies that just this month I was in New Mexico talking to water scientists because I'm working on a series for this summer. And I think each of us understands how important water is, but we understand how important it is for different reasons. Well, when it comes to water scientists, some of them are really focused on underground water. Some of them are really focused on, you know, surface water. Some of them are really focused on whatever water you want, bubbly water, whatever it is, tap water.
Clean water.
Clean water, you know. Well, you name it. There's so many, yeah, sparkling water. There's so many specializations. And one of the things they were talking about is how, regardless of their specialization, it is one water, and we're running out of it. And one of them said, yes, but I don't know how to get the message across. And so they divided us up in little tables to work together, and just random numbers. And, you know, the idea was that we brought forth our area of expertise, and we could communicate a message to the rest of the tables. And I was telling Rebecca this morning that it was really interesting because some of the scientists were like, okay, how do we dumb this down so that people understand what we're saying? And I just laughed and I said, people understand water. you don't need to dumb it down, you know? What you need is a message. What's your message? And they were like, well, you know, like, well, the alkaline, you know, what? And I was like, is that the message or is the message that we're running out of water? Okay, the message is that we're running out of water. Okay, so, you know, so we needed to bring them back to the message. And I think, and one of the scientists said, well, the problem is that we don't know the research that geologists are doing because we specialize in this other type of, and I was like, man, I said, okay, if you had one wish, only one of your wishes could come true, what would it be? And they said, better collaboration among the sciences. We don't know what the social sciences does, and what they do is really good with people. They really know how to communicate with people. We don't know how to communicate with people. We have a bunch of research in certain areas, but we don't know how to share it. And they didn't say that water didn't disappear, although I'm pretty sure that that's their ultimate desire. But what they said is that we could better work with each other. And I think that's one of the challenges in communication today, is that everybody is siloed, and whether it's politically, whether it's socially, professionally, and how can you communicate when there's walls in front of you, on your sides, walls behind you. It's really difficult to communicate in your little box.
And I think, I mean, those are the questions for our panel, for you guys. Like, how do you break down those barriers? How do you communicate outside of silos? What are people doing to help bridge the gap? Getting back to the, I hate it when people say like the title in a book, but whatever, it's the title, Bridge the Gap.
I'd love to hear what Kathleen has to say about this, because she taught me so much when we worked on the Pope campaign together. But one comment before you do is we've been taking the Gen Z students to this summit, the Adobe Summit, where they see 18,000 marketers every year. And it's hilarious, actually, because the marketers will say, what do you think of Twitter? And the kids are like, we're not on it. So I don't think much about it. But one of the things I saw recently was there was a pyramid structure. And we were being taught by one of the lead communicators in the country. And the top of that silo is where you have the least interesting, you know, public conversations. You'd say it in front of anybody. Advertisers don't want to hit you there. It's not interesting. And where people have the most walls built up around them, where it's nearly impossible to reach them if you're an advertiser, are in these private chat rooms. Well, sometimes those private chat rooms are about music and really wonderful things. And sometimes they're about really awful things. And it's really, really difficult to get behind those rooms. So I'm interested to hear what Kathleen says, but I don't know the answer to that. And it's pretty scary. And I've worked with some companies right now that are literally trying to find, you know, where are terrorists, where are these activities happening? And they're happening deep in these subrooms, which are very, very difficult to find. It is not Google, it's not Twitter, it's not Reddit. They're just very...
It is Instagram.
It is. So.
All right. In 2007, I launched Shaq on Twitter. I'd been telling Shaq, Shaquille O'Neal was one of my clients, and I was saying, you know, this is really a perfect medium for you. You can talk directly to the fans, etc. And he's like, no. And one day I had built a deep listening tool called Buzz Manager to monitor my clients on the internet so I could help them build their brand and refine it and make sure it's right. And so one day in monitoring, I saw Shaq on Twitter, and I'm like, I texted him. I said, is this you on Twitter? And he says, no, call the attorneys. I said, no. Be your own larger than life self. He's 7'1", has a size 24 shoe. You know, he's a big guy. And you will obliterate this other guy. And then I called the New York Times NBA beat writer. And I said, this is the real Shaq on Twitter. And he said, what's Twitter? Shocking. Wrote a big article about it. And so... one of the things that happened, I monitored Shaq very closely because I never knew what he was going to say. And I didn't tell him what to say, but by monitoring, I'd say, they love your humor, they love, you know, this, you know, they love that, do more of this, do less of that. And so one day, at 5 in the morning, he tweeted out something about his 6-year-old son and how he had had a nightmare and how he was sitting with him on his lap trying to make him feel better. And his little boy said to him, "Daddy, when do you sleep?" And Shaq said, "I don't sleep, I dream." So what that did, that humanity in that single tweet, was what made this huge man normal, like every one of us. It was his humanity. He was a father like so many others of us, had a son who had a nightmare, and he got up in the middle of the night to calm his son down and at the same time inspire other people with the message, "I don't sleep, I dream," so that anything would be possible. I think the way we break through is we have to go back to a humanity. I go back to those two questions. What does what I want to say mean to the person I'm talking to, and why should they care? And I try to answer those questions as quickly and as well as I can. But I also try and put myself in their shoes and make sure that when I'm trying to communicate something, that I look at the humanity of it. And the more we do that as individuals, the better we will be as communicators. Yes, we've got to look people in the eye, and yes, we've got to be concise because of the attention span has shortened, and yes, we have to use vivid, understandable words and phrases, but it's the humanity. It's wanting to help someone understand and help you understand what they have to say, so it's really two-way. That's when it becomes communication.
The one area, because I think you're totally right. However, it's also the media is mediated, you know? And one thing that happened over the weekend was Naomi Wolf, this was last week actually, she had written a book. Did anybody hear about this controversy? She wrote a book called Obscene, and it was about the laws in England in the 1800s and in the 1900s. And the basis of her argument was that during the Victorian period, laws had gotten very strong and punishment for gay men was so bad that they were being killed for being gay. And she recorded this, or she talked about this in her book, because she said, "I've seen these Old Bailey records, and the ones that said death recorded are the ones where they have been put to death." But she was interviewed on a BBC radio show called Arts and Ideas, and the presenter said, actually, death recorded means that they were let free. And it was a way for the Victorians to ease up on these regulations around gay men, which completely defeated the entire premise of her book. And this was a discussion program on Arts and Ideas, and she was there with two other scholars. And he could have completely humiliated her on that program, but he pointed out the mistake, yet allowed her to be part of the conversation. And then in a subsequent show on Start the Week, they brought this up again, that she was on a panel, and they said, "Well, you know, there's a problem with your argument here." And she said, "Yes, that is a mistake, and I'm going to change it." And the presenter tried to push her on that, and the other people on the panel came to her rescue, and they said, "Just because she made a mistake here doesn't mean her argument is void. Like, there's still a lot that we need to learn from the past 200 years of how gay men were treated in England and how subsequently they were treated in the colonies." And my partner and I were talking about it, and we said, that would never happen in the United States. If she was on a panel in the United States, somebody would have said, really just drilled down on the fact that she'd made a mistake and she was a scholar and how horrible this was, and look at how nobody is really doing the proper research anymore. And it would have been very difficult for her to recover that. And I believe that would have happened, because Twitter really scorned her in the United States, whereas she was allowed in England to continue her conversation. So my
Twitter
question...
didn't.
The people
on
Twitter. Yeah.
There's a big difference there.
Twitter's a tool. Yeah, exactly. But I want to know what you think about how we can work with people who are controlling the conversations about how to be more aware of the ways in which you are creating spaces where humanity and dialogue is what you're looking to foster, as opposed to controversy clickbait.
Well, one thing I would say is, again, I'll go back to Gen Z. It is the most diverse generation ever in the history of the world. And they're very inclusive in many ways. And there's lots of instances, obviously, where kids are bullying other kids, whether online or offline. But the reality is fluid. I mean, there are probably 27 different terms for someone's sexuality now. And kids don't care. They don't give a flip. You know, as these kids who have been born into an internet world and have taken leadership roles, look at those kids from Stoneman High School. The leadership, the way they've moved people. Look at the 16-year-old who just was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize because of her movement for green space and the environment and what she's doing. These kids are changing the way media covers and the way adults think and look at things in a very different way. I'll go back to, what does this mean to the people you're talking to, and why should they care? And the better you can communicate that message in a concise way that they can understand, the less we'll have that paralysis and parameters that are put around something that's going to create a controversy.
And I'm embarrassed a bit that we've lived in this one ugly moment in time in which the communication channels weren't fully understood by everybody that was using them or tuning into them, but I definitely agree with the Gen Z students, and the media structure, fortunately, is changing. We're getting decentralized, and we are going to lose the mediators. So we have studios that are going out of business. We have blockchain and AI models that are changing the way that consumers and brands and people will interact.
I'm super excited, but I work for a radio station.
No. It's going to be great for public media, actually. I'm so excited. I mean, I started out as a public journalist, so believe me, it's something that's so critical to me. What we're losing are the brokers in the middle. But the Gen Z students are entirely creative. So I've been working with the Ann Richards School for 2 years in a row now. And in fact, Rebecca turned on the internship. And when I go to do the internship interviews, I always ask them, what have you done lately? They are all trained in creative suites. And so they're videographers. And when I talk to them, they're not doing short form. They're not necessarily doing Twitter. They're all over YouTube. And half of them are making films now, and they're talking about their own journeys in their long form. So I'm actually optimistic that with the kids as creators, that we're going to see a return to long form, and that the channels will invite it.
And one of the things that you touched on is the diversity of this generation. It's one of the riches of this country is how diverse we are, how we can speak different languages, how we come from different stories, from different worlds. That is one of the reasons why I honestly believe, and maybe I believe it because I arrived here as an adult, but I honestly believe this is such a powerful nation because it's made of fearless people. People who left everything behind to come here, and I am one of them. And so when you think about the diversity of this country, it's a plus. We need to start singing the praises of that diversity because it enriches us. And our kids are learning that. They know it. They just were born into this richness and they embrace it. And that's one of the things that I try to do with my stories. I believe the more people feel identified with the characters of a story, the more they embrace a story. How can more people feel identified with the characters of the story? Well, if we have men and women in the story, if we have men and women of different colors in the story, if we have men and women and children with different accents in the story, because that's what our society looks like. And if you feel identified with one of the characters in the story, you embrace the story. The other day, my daughter and I were in the library. Our public library is amazing. We just have to say that, right? I love the public library. And I spent countless hours there when my kids were little, and now they go by themselves, and I can enjoy a coffee somewhere else. But but one of the things that happened recently is we went in right as they were about to close because my daughter knew exactly what she was looking for, except she didn't know the name of the book. But she knew what it looked like, and she thought she could find it. So she goes in and starts getting frustrated 30 seconds later, right? Because she knows what it looks like, but she doesn't know what it's called. She doesn't know the name of the author. She doesn't know if it's part of a series. And the librarian says to her, "What are you looking for?" And she says, "I'm looking for a book that I loved, and I left it when it was like two pages before I finished it." And she says, "What does it look like?" And my daughter says, "The main character looks exactly like me." What do you think my daughter looks like? She's a brown girl with curly black hair. And the librarian says, "I know what book you're looking for." And I thought, oh my God, you gotta be kidding me. She did. She did. She found the book. And my daughter was just ecstatic. You know why she found the book? Because there aren't many books with kids who look like her. So it is a success story, but it's also one story that we need to be mindful about. You know, how can we communicate when we don't speak to the people who are going to read us? How can we communicate when we don't speak to the ears that will listen to us?
Or, you know, understand their language.
Or understand their language. You know, one of my biggest frustrations in Texas is that in a majority-minority state, we still get chastised when we are struggling to find the right word in English, you know, or look down upon. And it's like, no, we are so rich because of the diversity. But that's a conversation for another day. All I'm saying is that one of the richness of the next generation is that they don't see this. They just celebrate it.
And, you know, one thing that Lana, you touched upon, and Joy also, is this idea of public media. You mentioned public media, the power of public media, and this also the going to a librarian to help you find something. You know, that is going to a public institution to help you find something that is open to everyone. So talk a little bit about how you, before we open it up for questions, because we're going to do that next, but how do we... how do we state that public media is important when we are so focused and driven on a market-based society? How do we reiterate the value of public institutions and public media?
Can I just share a quick story? Our daughter, Megan, founded the Foundation for Tomorrow for Orphaned and Vulnerable Children and Education Reform in Tanzania. And one of the first things she did was take in kids that from age five, they'd push kids out onto the streets from the orphanages and they'd die or go into slavery or whatever. And so she put them into English-speaking boarding schools in Tanzania so they'd have a home and an education. And one of the first things she did was build a library in one of these schools. And my husband and I went over for the dedication of the library. And Scholastic had given her something like 5,000 books for the library and so on. And it was in between semesters, and we cut the ribbon, and there were about 300 people there, adult and kids, which was shocking because we didn't expect anybody really. When we cut that ribbon, those adults and children ran for the books. My husband and I looked at each other like, we have never seen such a thing in the United States. We have this wealth of opportunity and books and resources. When they don't have them and they get a taste of it, they want more and more. We need to remember that.
Yeah, privilege makes us lethargic sometimes.
And so that's exactly the question. How do we tell each other? Public institutions are important, providing information, education, entertainment to everyone is an important endeavor. How do we go about stating that and restating that?
It's going to look different. It's like blockchain. I was reading not too long ago about how in Austin, Texas, some organization had gotten a grant for blockchain, and they were going to work with the homeless people of Austin, and they were going to make their medical records available on blockchain, their histories, everything, all their personal important documents were going to be available on blockchain, because when they went to a hospital for help or they went to a shelter, they'd be able to have access to something so that they'd have an identity. So I don't think the libraries are going to continue to look like the libraries that we know them. They're going to be different. They're going to have e-books. They're going to have videos. They're going to have games. We're going to learn. Gen Z does not believe that they have to learn in traditional ways. If they want to learn something, they'll go to YouTube. So we have to still think about public access to information and public institutions, but we can't possibly imagine that they're going to look and smell and sound and be the same as those that we grew up with.
And public institutions need to get fit. They're out of shape. You know, public institutions need to rebuild relationships. It's all about relationships, really, in life. You trust the people you know, and you don't trust the people you don't know. And with institutions, it's the same thing. You trust an institution that you know and speaks to you and relates to you and fulfills your need, but you don't trust an institution that stabs you in the back or hurts you or overcharges you or, you know. And so I'm pretty sure that organizations at the top are also having these conversations and thinking, what do we do? What are the next 10 years, 20 years, 50 years going to look like for us if we want to survive?
What's the next 10 months going to look like if we want to survive?
Even if the funding models change in the way that we do public media changes, we still need to protect public media, because we are one country and not the best if you look at the way that our public media is operating today in terms of freedom of the press and freedom of the media. But if we don't protect it, and we didn't have to when Everett Parker, my 90-year-old professor, was fighting for media in the public interest in the 1950s, before his wife introduced televisions to the department stores for the first time, the first three networks were on KKK property, or at least I think maybe it was one of the three. But he was shot at when he went and he fought for universal access policy laws, and that's where they came from. Now, if you look around the world, what are we seeing? We're seeing journalists are being killed more than ever, and we're not protecting them. If we look at the last time I was here, fortunately, because it was an amazing conversation, but Rebecca was on stage with Lawrence Wright from the Looming Tower, Pulitzer Prize winning, and Jamal Khashoggi, who now is not a lot of people in the name in the room knew his name that evening, but everybody right around the world knows his name now. And we asked him during that conversation what he thought of public media in his own country. Well, they didn't have it in Saudi Arabia. Tunisia was the only country in the Middle East that really had a public media of any sort then. So we are at risk of looking more and more, and we're already falling on the charts, like other countries that have no diversity, that have private institutions and government controlling their media, if we don't protect it. So I think the onus is on us to not allow history to repeat itself, and not to see in a country that we believe is the United States of America the lack of public media, which in today's environment is dividing us to a degree. I think the kids are going to change that, but it's truly important that we teach one another the value of it, or we're going to lose it.
And we're sitting on public land. We're at a public university, and we have to keep universities free, areas for free speech, where you can explore and understand other ways of thinking and doing things. And that is being hurt right now, without a doubt. When we create safe rooms where people can go just so they don't have to be around people who aren't like them or talking about things who aren't like them on campuses like exist today, safe areas, you know, the world is so big and bold out there. If we're going to teach our young people to think big and to make changes in a way that are going to dramatically move this world forward, they have to hear other people's opinions about things that they've never even explored before. And where better than to do it in universities and places of public interest?
Well, let's open things up for some questions, because I remember one thing that Jamal said that night, which was, this would never happen in Saudi Arabia, an event like this. And so it's really important that you're here, and it's also important that, you know, your voice is heard and that you participate in this type of public dialogue. So thank you for coming, and please just raise your hand if you have a question. Amy's got the mic. Thank you, Amy Chambliss.
Hi, this was a great discussion, and thank you all. Joy was talking about trust. And, you know, in the last few years, we've heard the term fake news get used over and over. And whether you agree with that, you know, in some cases or not, there has been an erosion of trust because of this immediate assumption on a lot of people's part that it is fake. How do we get that trust back? Not just in the media outlets, but as communicators.
I thought you were going to jump in. I like to always talk about life in terms of relationships. And I think for those of us who have been partnered at some point in time, we understand what trust means and what breaking trust means and what gaining trust means. And regaining trust when trust has been destroyed is really difficult. We all know that from relationships. But I think the truth is always going to prevail. It's not the easy path forward, but it's the only path forward. So for us in the media, I think it's all about resistance, and it's all about speaking truth and showing truth, demonstrating with numbers, with case studies, with examples. You know, if you say China is paying for something, how come our farmers are paying for it too? Two people cannot be paying for the same thing. So it's all about the truth and the truth and the truth. And the Bible says the truth shall set you free. It takes a long time, but building trust is that way. When trust is destroyed in a marriage and with children, wherever you go, it takes time, but it prevails.
At We Are Gen Z, we do original research with, again, over 1,000 teens several times a year, probably as much as 10 times a year. And we did one this past year, in fact, several months ago, on where Gen Z gets their news and information and what they trust. And it was quite interesting because there were over 1,200 respondents to the survey. And the number one place that they get their news and information is Instagram, and number two is Google. But the entities that they trust most were traditional media outlets. The reason that there was such a disparity there was because the traditional media outlets didn't make it as easy, the access for them, the frictionless access. I think as a traditional media outlet, all they need to do to gain, not just gain trust, but to gain more people who trust them, is literally to make the information more accessible and interesting on the platforms where people go. You have to communicate where people are, not where you want them to be.
Oh, yes. So true.
I'm not such an optimist, by the way. So
that's why they invited us.
to balance it out. Yeah. Well, I think that we need to verify it a little bit now. So there's just so much being thrown at everybody every single day, and there's so much garbage getting thrown out, and it's coming at us fast, and it's coming at us through a lot of channels. And quite honestly, with Google being the number one, that's like really disheartening. Scary. Because it's a commercial platform. So most of the things, if you're searching it on, you know, searching for love on Google, there's probably a pill for it. And you'll probably see that in the first two pages of the rankings. And so there are some public for good corporations out there. In fact, one that I'm on the board of that are actually her, she's a lawyer out of Denver, and her algorithm just went viral just because it does simple rankings of the fair and balanced nature of news. And we are looking for ways to actually almost give the data out for free to advertisers that actually don't want to be next to the garbage. So you've seen now recently big advertisers pull out of things. Not to call them out, news content of every persuasion that's not fair and balanced. And so I think that, you know, we are going to have to treat it from a number of different angles and just not hope that it goes away and that we can gain that trust. I think we're going to have to invest in doing some things to get it back.
Actually, MediaWise is going into the schools. They've gotten grants from the Pew Institute and Journalism and Google and some other to go into the schools and teach young people in the high schools and the middle schools how to differentiate fake news from real news, what to look for in the headlines, how to verify where the information is coming from, and so on. And I think we need more and more of that, because there is truly fake news, and then there's fake news that just isn't news that you agree with.
But also there's news that sounds real, looks real, it comes from verified sources, but in reality, it appeals to the ignorance of a lot of people. My brother-in-law is, you know, he's a chemist, he's super educated, you know, speaks five languages, and the other day he texted me something, and I replied, fake news. And he said, it's from CNN. I said, I don't care where it's from. State law trumps that. And therefore, it's not true. And they're Supreme Court precedent. And he was like, oh. You know, and it's not a matter of whether the information sounds correct or comes from the same source, from a correct source. It's also a general knowledge of how society works. Like, a lot of people are really ignorant about how society works, how laws work, how government works. And, you know, they read something, it kind of makes sense, and therefore it must be true. But I feel like my job is to constantly say, that's not true because that's not how it works in the system. You know, so it's a little complicated.
Yeah. Another question? Go ahead.
Wow, I don't know where to start. There's so many questions. That's really good information. Specifically with the propaganda machine and FUD, which is fear, uncertainty, and doubt. You just spoke just a little bit to it, like, and you know, fake news, but this is another level. Specifically with Gen Z, I'm seeing it a lot with Tesla. I'm an investor and I own Tesla and I'm following the story. To me, it's the iPhone when Blackberries were cool. And it's obvious as an early adopter and as an influencer and these other things, but I'm watching all of this FUD and it seems to be affecting generations that can afford a Tesla. Right, so maybe my generation, y'all's generation, somebody else. But what do you think about it? It seems like the Gen Z generation is kind of like not buying it, not buying the FUD. They're kind of like almost like pushing it away and entertaining themselves instead. And you know, so can you speak on that a little bit and expand?
Well, mental health issues are among the highest concerns of Gen Z today because they do fear and not understand. But we aren't giving kids the benefit of the doubt. You know, what I find over and over and over again is when we ask young people their opinions and we listen to them, they are so thrilled that somebody wants to know what they think, that they will share that information. But they grew up, you know, Gen Z literally was born into a world that had the internet. They didn't live in a non-internet society. So when they want information, I used to go to Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, in the room in my dad's study and look something up. When they want to know something, they'll Google it and they'll get all different angles on it, not just one perspective or one little slice. So they ask why. Why is their biggest question? And it's not meant to be rude. It's meant because they need to understand context. But think about it. They're born post 9/11, so into a world where there's been huge disaster here in the United States and around the world, and they've seen the results of it. They look at millennials who are burdened with college debt up the kazoo that they don't want. Now they're going into jobs that they don't care about. They're still living at home with their parents because they can't afford to pay for their college tuition or their college loans. So Gen Z is very frugal because they don't want to be in that same boat. So I don't think they're pushing it away and just want games and fun at all. They are a much older generation for their age because they were born into a different world and they don't want the world that we've left for them. They want to make it better.
And with FUD and fear and uncertainty and doubt, you may have fake news and you may have folks that are preying on older folks and saying they're going to come and take your guns. But what I think with different generations, you have different fears. And so with younger students, they're experiencing epidemics of loneliness right now. They're growing up on social media and they're not out in the public sphere. They're dating later. Depending on your beliefs, they're sexually active later or just less, and the dating environment has changed. And they're dealing with fears of their own. And I know that there's parents in this room that are dealing with significant, you know, fears, and the way that they're getting approached is different. So I don't think FUD changes. I think it's, you know, the concern should be, you know, the fear of missing out right now. They're competing with the whole world. You might have been competing with the girl next door or down the block, but now they can see, you know, the Kardashians running around with zillions of dollars, and that's not the experience for, you know, 200, 300 million people have very, very different experiences.
So the optimist in me says that the fear is different, but one of the beautiful things about the difference in fear is that, you know, in the past they used to tell us, you know, X people are coming to get your jobs. Now you know it's not true because you're not communicating just with your neighbors. You are Googling stuff and you're meeting people from, you know, South Korea. You're meeting people from, you know, Venezuela. You're meeting people from, you know, Norway, and your children are in chat rooms with them. And so you understand that the dynamics of they is different. They is not somebody that we fear anymore or that this generation fears anymore. But yes, the fears are different, the fear of being alone. And so it's a period of adaptation for everybody, I think.
Another question? We have time for about two more questions.
So I had the unfortunate experience of seeing a required statement on our local Sinclair station recently.
Oh,
yeah, and I knew who was owned by Sinclair locally. I had never seen it. I don't watch that station much, and I was horrified. It felt as you would expect, you know, insincere and highly biased. So we talk about trusting the media. I think a lot of older people, I'm assuming, still watch local news. I think the younger people are certainly getting their news elsewhere.
I don't want to cut you off, but for the other people in the room that might not know about those notifications, can you tell them?
Okay, so as I understand it, Sinclair requires, and I don't know how frequently, a pre-prepared statement to be read by their newscasters. And if you've been on YouTube at all, they have these great clips where it's newscasters from this station reading it, and then they cut to the exact same sentence. You know, it just goes, and it is nationwide.
And what is it? What is it?
It's...
What's the essence of it?
It's a very right-wing, very biased statement, and it varies on the subject matter, but you can look at it and it smells bad and it looks bad.
And they're the only source of news in many POs around the U.S.
Yes, yes. Especially rural places.
With very limited access to high-speed internet, or you're not Googling out there, you're not getting videos out there, you're getting Sinclair.
Right. And so my question is, how terrifying should that be? And what can we as citizens do to combat that? Because I'm assuming now that the FCC rules have changed, it's actually allowing that. So what can we do about that?
Let's clarify. Like, what exactly is the message that's going out over Sinclair, and what are the Sinclair-owned media organizations?
So when you have a single source of news in a rural area, that limits the news that you get. And so I think what we're concerned about is that people without access to the internet, right, you can look up anything you want in certain areas. And so if you have one news source, you're only getting, it's kind of this very interesting change, and we've made pretty accurate assumptions during gerrymandering or political elections, which happen digitally or through news sources, that if the only voices you hear are one-sided voices, that you may be inclined to think a certain way. And so it's really, it's a lack of public media, if you will, in those rural POs, because there is not, you don't have access to diverse sources. And I didn't get into that messages, but I've been following the Sinclair thing a lot because it's the anti-universal access policy laws are happening now, and it's terrifying.
And I don't know the message verbatim, but it's it sounds like the magoger, ¿cómo se dice? Demagogia. It sounds like propaganda. Yeah. It sounds like propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I thought was really interesting was that before the election of Trump, that if you looked at newspapers and even television news, and I asked a couple reporters from KUT, you know, would it be possible that Trump could be elected? And they said, no. Here are the reports.
Didn't ask me either.
Not you though. But if you listen to radio and audio sources, especially in the Midwest, a lot of especially right-wing radio stations were sending messages via the phone to their listeners and making sure that it was very easy for people to get audio. So it is interesting how people are getting information to people all over the country via these different routes that aren't necessarily the internet or traditional media outlets.
Well, I can tell you one thing about the election. As reporters, we are or try to be non-political, and we try to be just to be fact-based. And I don't think that what I'm going to say is political. But growing up in a different country taught me that the election of President Trump was not only possible, but almost inevitable. And I saw it in 2000 when President Fox came to office in Mexico. He was a disruptor. He spoke like people spoke. He was the first in Mexico. You may not know this, but presidents have to be married. It's one of the things. They have to be married. And Vicente Fox was not married. He was divorced, and he was having an affair with his communications person who was married. And he would tell people, so what, and who cares, and use words that were not kosher. And he got elected. And to see a person like that get elected taught me that, when people feel that somebody from the, like, who is like us, right, starts running, not only can they get elected, but it's very, very likely that they will. And the environment was ripe for that. And the media in New York and the media in Washington were not giving him the time of day. We're laughing at him. And I just shook my head and thought, we haven't learned about other countries. We haven't learned from other countries. We truly believe in our exceptionalism. And, and it's time for us to realize that it can happen. And it did.
Well, we're coming to past 7 o'clock, and I know that the union is closed, so we have to wrap it up. But I just want a few closing statements. You know, where are we? What can we do? How can we be vigilant? What is ahead? A few closing statements that, you know, should take about 10 or so hours. But just a few words of wisdom from you remarkable ladies here on the panel this evening.
I would say that our leaders today more than ever need to be excellent communicators, not in the traditional sense, but in recognizing the world around them and how it has changed and how they have to change to adapt to that. But they have to make it a top priority that whatever they know, understand, their passions, their directions, their visions, they have to be able to articulate them or there is no chance.
And I would say, do you guys know the what they teach children in schools when there's a shooting? What do they say? Is it hide, fight, and run? Or what are the three words that they teach?
Something like that.
Yeah, it used to be.
Stop, drop, and roll.
I think it is, you know, hide, fight, if there's no other.
And run,
run, right? I think it is. And I would say the same thing to you. Because if something, you know, we have this sense that tells us when something is dangerous. And if you sense danger, I think protect yourself. If you cannot protect yourself, fight. If you cannot fight, run. Because if you smell danger, it's because it's there.
I might actually be the optimist now. So I would just say... I would say just keep doing this because nobody can take us from each other. So just keep encouraging public discourse. Go out to your coffee shops. Go out to things like Pecha Kucha and the Cactus Cafe. And it's free.
Free? Open to the public.
Open to the public. Donate on your way out the door. And let's keep doing this.
Yeah, on that note, you know, there's a story that I love to tell about Susan Sontag when she was putting on Waiting for Godot in Sarajevo during the war. And in an interview afterward, the interviewer asked the theater director and Susan Sontag, why would you ever do this? You know, it's the middle of a war zone. Why would you put on Waiting for Godot? And, you know, the actors aren't even, they're starving, there's no electricity. And the theater director said, you know, there's a misconception in wartime. And everybody thinks it is to stay alive. But the actual battle is to remain human in each moment. And I think it's a really profound thought when we think about all the wars that are going on and how, no matter what we're fighting against or running from, the real challenge is to remain human. So yes, go to the Cactus Cafe, go to the coffee shops, do all of that wonderful stuff, listen to KUT, donate, and we hope to see you again. Thank you to our wonderful panel, Kathleen and Joy and Lana. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you for coming out tonight. Have a wonderful evening.